This is class number 6 in the Econ 111 Economics course. Please make sure to submit your assignments for chapters 8 and 9 that are due, as well as the extra credit work associated with those chapters if you chose to do the extra credit work. In this class and the next class, I'm going to be going over some material that you will need to know to do some of your extra credit work. In addition, it will be helpful for those planning to take an AP Economics exam. Some of this material is a review of material previously covered, but much of the material will be new for you. I would like to first of all begin by discussing a topic that we had already discussed, and that is short run versus long run. These are two terms that you will frequently encounter in the study of economics. Economics, of course, like all other disciplines, has its own specialized terminology, and part of studying economics is learning that specialized terminology. And one example are the terms short run and long run. The short run is a time period in which a business has at least one fixed input. For example, the production space of a building is fixed. The short run is a time period in which a business has at least one fixed input. The long run is a time period in which the firm has flexibility to change all inputs. So it may buy more or bigger machines, hire more workers, expand the building, etc. How long the long run is depends on the nature of the business. Some businesses can change their inputs faster than other businesses. Now let's consider terms that I just used, fixed inputs and variable inputs. Fixed inputs are resources which the firm keeps constant in the short run. Variable inputs may increase or decrease as production increases or decreases. Examples of resources that are typically fixed in the short run are land, heavy machinery, and buildings. Resources that are usually variable in the short run are energy, raw materials, and supplies. Two other terms you need to understand are average product and marginal product. Average product is production per worker. For example, if 3 workers produce 15 cars, the average product is 5, calculated by dividing the 3 workers into the total of 15 cars they produced. So 15 divided by the 3 workers equals 5, and that is the average product. Marginal product is how much an extra worker adds to the output. For example, a 4th worker joins this hypothetical company. Total production rises to 19 from 15 units. So total production goes from 15 units all the way up to 19 units. Marginal product of this 4th worker then is 4, because with the new worker, total production rose by 4 units. In other words, 19 units minus the 15 units when there were simply 3 workers. Now here is a question for you to consider. If the firm's total production is 19 units and there are now 4 workers, what is the average product of the 4 workers? The answer to this question is 4.75 units, which is calculated by 19 divided by 4. 19 total units divided by the 4 workers gives you the average product of 4.75. In Exhibit 13 of the exhibits accompanying these lectures, you can see two tables of the marginal and average product for the firm as the number of its workers increases. In general, the definition of marginal product is this: the change in total production divided by the change in the number of workers. In table number 1 of exhibit 13, we have data for each worker from 1 through 6. If we do not have data for each worker, the table may look like table number 2. Note that in table number 2 of exhibit 13, the values for average product have not changed from table number 1. Only the marginal product values have, because the number of workers for whose production was known skipped by 2, and the general definition had to be applied. Now, we have previously discussed the law of diminishing marginal product. You will recall in the last class we discussed this law. The law of diminishing marginal product states that when a firm uses a variable input, such as labor, the productivity of workers who are hired at a later stage is less than the additional productivity of workers who were hired first. Because of the fixed inputs, there are not enough machines and offices to comfortably accommodate these employees. Subsequently, these workers are not as productive as the third worker. Additional output of the fourth worker is 4 products. The fifth brings in 3, and the sixth employee only contributes an extra 1 product. Diminishing marginal product takes effect after the third worker. Keep in mind that this law applies to production behavior of a firm in the short run. That is, one or more factors of production are fixed. In most cases, as we've said before, that would be something like land or machinery, or the fixed inputs. In the long run, it is possible to add machines and increase the size of an office, etc., so the reasons for diminishing returns can become non-existent. It is possible in the long run that marginal production declines, but it is for different reasons. Now let's consider some new concepts relating to what are called cost functions and utils. Now, in order to understand cost functions, we have to understand certain additional concepts or terms that economists typically use. And two of these terms are what are called explicit cost versus implicit cost. Economists classify these types of cost: explicit or accounting cost and implicit cost. Explicit costs are out-of-pocket, obvious kinds of cost. For example, expenses on books, tuition, gas, etc. Implicit costs are not really expenses you incur, but involve income or values you are giving up by not doing something that you could have chosen to do. For instance, if you decide to go to school full-time instead of working a $20,000 job, you are giving up earning $20,000. This is your implicit cost. Another term for it you will often hear is opportunity cost. And that's an important term to understand, opportunity cost. And again, that is another term for that is an implicit cost. So it bears repeating. An example of an opportunity cost, or another term for it is implicit cost, is what you would have to give up by not doing something that you could have chosen to do. So it's not, you know, you don't necessarily see an opportunity cost on the profit and loss statement of a company. You won't see it there. But if a company, whatever decisions a company makes, then and engages in certain activities, then it foregoes engaging in other activities. And the opportunity cost are those the profits that could have perhaps been made from those foregone activities. Now let's consider this sample problem. Suppose you are running a small business and incur the following expenses. Labor equals $80,000. Raw materials equals $30,000. Finance charges on a loan equal $3,000. You are not paying explicit rent because you own the building you are operating in. If you would rent it out, however, you could be earning $12,000. You also estimate your own time to be worth $25,000. So now, what are your expenses? Well, the explicit cost here would be the $80,000 in labor, the $30,000 in raw material, and the $3,000 in finance charges on a loan. And that totals $113,000. But now the implicit costs are the $12,000 in foregone rent because you own the building you are operating in. In other words, if instead of owning the building you had to rent it, then that would be $12,000. That's an implicit cost. And another implicit cost is the $25,000 you are worth in the marketplace, because if you didn't own this business, you could go out and work and maybe make $25,000 at another job. So the implicit cost or the opportunity cost here are $12,000 plus $25,000, which totals $37,000. So what now then are the total economic cost of doing business for this business? Well, the total economic cost equal the explicit cost plus the implicit cost. So if we add the $113,000 in explicit cost plus the $37,000 in implicit cost, we come up with a total economic cost of $150,000. So in this example, total economic costs are $150,000, but total accounting costs are only $113,000. Remember, accounting costs are just another term for explicit cost. Paralleling this difference between accounting cost versus implicit cost, there are what is called accounting profits versus economic profits. Let's consider then accounting versus economic profits. To calculate accounting and economic profits, we need to know the company's total revenue. Again, we've already talked about this business's cost, so in order to know its profits, we of course need to know its revenues, because revenues minus cost equal profits. So in terms of revenue, let's suppose the revenues are $140,000. Then let's now calculate accounting profits. We take the total revenues minus the explicit cost, or $140,000 minus $113,000 equals $27,000. And those are the accounting profits. Economic profits are total revenue minus total economic cost, or $140,000 minus $150,000 equal negative $10,000, in other words, a loss of $10,000. The above firm reaps a positive accounting profit, but the negative economic profit indicates that from an economic point of view, economically speaking, the owner should discontinue the operation. He could make more money being an employee than trying to be an employer. In other words, he could rent out his building And as we had said earlier, if he had rented out his building, he would get $12,000 for that. And then if he took another job, he would get $25,000. And so he would be better off, going, basically selling his business, renting out his building, and, working as an employee for someone else in terms of when one would consider his opportunity cost. So again, to repeat, the above firm reaps a positive accounting profit, but the negative economic profit indicates that from an economic point of view, economically speaking, the owner should discontinue the operation. All right, now let's continue on considering cost functions. Exhibit 14 lists the 7 cost functions that students need to understand. Now let me go over these 7 cost functions. Number 1, total variable cost. That is the cost of all variable resources. Examples include cost of labor, materials, office supplies. Number 2, total fixed cost. That is the cost of all fixed inputs. Examples include cost of the building, large pieces of machinery, and certain taxes. Number 3 is total cost. This is the sum of total variable cost and total fixed cost. Number 4 is average variable cost. This is variable cost per product. Number 5, average fixed cost. This is fixed cost per product. Number 6, average total cost. This is total cost per product. Number 7, marginal cost. This is the cost of producing an additional unit of the product. All right, let's now do some cost calculations using these various cost functions. Exhibit 14 shows the various cost functions how the cost functions formulaically relate. So, for example, average total cost equals total cost divided by Q, where Q equals the quantity produced. So, stated another way, average total cost equals total cost divided by the quantity produced. Average fixed cost equals the total fixed cost divided by Q, Q being the total quantity produced. Average variable cost equals total variable cost divided by Q. And marginal cost equals the change in total cost divided by the change in Q. Again, where Q equals the quantity produced. All right, here is an example in which we get to use these various cost functions. Let's suppose you are making 50 bottles of grape juice each week. You know that your fixed cost add up to $300 and your variable cost amount to $900. You also know that if you were to make an extra 5 bottles, your total cost would rise by $60. What is your total cost? Your average total cost, your average variable cost, your average fixed cost, and your marginal cost. Well, using this example, the total cost equals $300, which in fixed cost, plus $900 in variable cost. In other words, $1,200. Average total cost, given that you are producing 50 bottles of grape juice, $1,200 divided by 50 equals $24, and that would be your average total cost. Average variable cost equals The $900 in total variable cost divided by the 50 bottles equals $18 average variable cost. Average fixed cost would be, in this example, $300 divided by 50 equals $6. And your marginal cost would be $60, remembering again that we said that $60 would be how much your total cost would rise by adding an extra 5 bottles. So $60 divided by those 5 bottles equals $12 as your marginal cost for this firm. Exhibit 15 shows cost curves of a typical firm. It is important that you study these cost curve graphs and come to understand them. For instance, consider graph 1 in Exhibit 15. Notice that in this graph, when output is 0, that total variable cost is $0. But total fixed cost is $50. By its very definition, total fixed cost does not vary with level of output. Also, notice that total cost equals total variable cost plus total fixed cost. Notice that when output equals 6 units, that total fixed cost equals $50 and total variable cost equals $100. So total cost at that level of output equals $150. Finally, notice the typical shape of the total variable cost and total cost curves. This is owing to the fact that the marginal cost typically is great to begin with, but declines and then starts to rise again. Now consider graph 2. You can see how marginal cost declines until the level of output is 4 units. And so long as marginal cost is less than the average variable cost, then the average variable cost continues to decline. But at 6 units of output, the marginal cost becomes greater than the average variable cost, and the average variable cost then begins to rise. And when the marginal cost starts to become greater than average total cost, then the average total cost begins to rise. But notice how average fixed cost continually declines as output increases because the set level of fixed cost is divided over more units of output. Exhibit 16 shows the long-run average cost curve. The long-run average cost curve is derived from a number of short-run average cost curves. For each fixed plant size in the short run, you look at the lowest cost for that size plant. These bottom portions of the different short-run cost curves make up a long-run average cost curve. A firm's long-run average cost curve is the envelope of many short-run average cost curves. All inputs are variable, and the firm has the choice of building or changing to a variety of plant or facility sizes. A small operation which wants to produce 300 units, in this example, shown in the exhibit, will have an average cost of $26. A larger one, which produces 700 units, can produce each product for $17, taking advantage of economies of scale. When the firm gets too large, then average costs rise to $20, and that exhibits that there is what is called a diseconomy of scale. In this Exhibit 16 graph, notice how the long-run average cost decreases up to a certain level, in this case 700 units, but then starts to increase. Why do you think that is the case? In order to understand why the long-run average cost curve typically follows this pattern, it is necessary to understand economies and diseconomies of scale. Increasing returns to scale is closely associated with the concept of economies of scale, the downward sloping part of the long-run average total cost curve. Decreasing returns to scale relates to diseconomies of scale, which is the upward part of the long-run average cost curve. Increasing returns to scale occurs when a firm increases its inputs and a more than proportionate increase in production results. For example, 1 year a firm employs 200 workers and 50 machines and produces 1,000 products. A year later, it increases the number of workers to 400 and the machines to 100, so that the inputs doubled, and the output rises to a level of 2,500, more than doubled. Increasing returns to scale is often accompanied by decreasing long-run average cost, which is known as economies of scale. A firm which gets bigger may experience this because of increased specialization, more efficient use of large pieces of machinery, for example, use of assembly lines, volume discounts, etc. So the reason why the long-run average cost curve declines up to a certain point is because of something known as economies of scale. Companies that specialize more or enjoy volume discounts get to decrease their cost, average cost per product, and gain certain efficiencies, and this allows the overall long-run average cost curve to be less, which is called an economy of scale. But decreasing returns to scale can be associated with rising long-run average cost, known as diseconomies of scale. And an organization may become too big, thus creating too many layers of management, too many departments, and too much red tape. This can lead to a lack of communication, inefficiency, and delays in decision-making. So there is such a thing as diseconomies of scale, and in terms of this long-run average cost curve that we see in our exhibit, that we see that happening when the cost curve is rising. Notice that it begins to rise after 700 units. So after 700 units, in the that exhibit 16, there becomes diseconomies of scale. But below 700 units, as one increases up to 700 units, there is economies of scale, such that the long run cost declines. Okay. Also, you do have a situation where there can be constant returns to scale, and that occurs when the firm's output rises proportionate to the increase in inputs. Now let's consider the economic concept of marginal utility. We've looked at it in another class, but it's important to understand the concept and then to build upon that concept. Marginal utility is marginal utility is the additional satisfaction one gets from consuming one more item of a good or service. Satisfaction is measured in utils, and that's just a term that sometimes economists use. In some sense, it's just a little concept they use. Utils, U-T-I-L-S. You might sometimes hear of that. Let's say that you are about to eat a pizza consisting of 6 slices. The first piece might give you 140 utils of satisfaction. The second slice, your hunger, somewhat satisfied after the first, yields only 60 utils. The third's down to 20 utils, and a possible fourth if forced upon you, could produce negative additional utils. So it's just a way of measuring satisfaction, this term utils. Now, the law of diminishing marginal utility, which we have discussed previously, let's now consider it in light of what we've just said about these utils. Referring back to the example in the previous case, you can see that the marginal utility declines as the person consumes more slices of pizza. This is typical of almost all consumption. But again, I mean consumption of a material nature. The more you have of something, the less additional unit is worth to you. This phenomenon explains why if you are shopping in a supermarket, you only buy a limited quantity of goods. As the marginal utility of, for example, the fifth orange declines, you may decide that this orange is not worth your additional expense. Well, I think we will close off the class at that point. The assignment for Chapter 12 is due by class number 8. Those who want to do the extra credit work should do the work described in Exhibit 5.